please.
Case number SCWC 29923, State v. Durham, arguing for the petitioner, Leslie Iskovitz, arguing for respondent, Peter Hanano, argument on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. Mr. Iskovitz, I understand you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes.
Okay. All right, if you'd like to proceed with your argument then, and we'll have a light for you when you're at your 10 minutes.
Come on. Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, may it please the court. I'm Leslie Iskovitz, attorney for the petitioner appellant, Cornelius Wesley Durham. Chief Justice Reckonwald and other esteemed justice and Justice Judge Border, I would like to express our immense gratitude and appreciation for accepting Mr. Durham's petition for writ of certiorari and for letting us argue this morning. The first of three issues in our petition is whether the circuit court abused its discretion where the record did not support the findings that petitioner had willfully and inexcusably violated a substantial condition of his probation. Petitioner was originally sentenced to 5 years of probation, and as part of his sentence, he was required to participate in an approved Hawaii SOTP program. There is no dispute that Mr. Durham fully complied with all the terms of his probation. His Oahu-based probation officer who supervised him testified that at the revocation hearing that he maintained two jobs, paid all of his fees, committed no new offenses, and never missed an appointment. The dispute in this case is whether petitioner satisfactorily participated in an approved Hawaii SOTP program during his initial 19-month time on probation. There is no dispute.
Morning, counsel. Before you go any further, I'd like to ask a few questions regarding your role in this case. Would you agree that your letter dated June 25, 2008, to Mr. Durham's probation officer and therapist started a chain of events which had an unfortunate end for Mr. Durham?
Most definitely, Your Honor.
And you sent the letter because you were upset that neither the probation officer or therapist would return your phone calls, correct?
No, I sent the letter because they had restricted personal freedoms of him that I thought were far beyond what was allowed, that should not have been done without some kind of discussion, without some kind of looking at whether or not they have the right to restrict his personal freedoms in that way.
Well, let me just read the second paragraph of your letter. As you know, this office represents Cornelius Wesley Durham in the matter regarding his terms of probation. I left telephone messages for both of you on two occasions, June 6th and June 11th, identifying myself as Mr. Durham's attorney and asking you both to return my calls. For reasons unknown to me, both of you have chosen to ignore my phone messages, and that's why you sent the letter.
Yeah, I sent the letter because that's correct. They did not respond to my
email. You know, at the time you sent the letter, wasn't Mr. Durham represented by the Public Defender's Office?
No, he was at the time he was represented by Phil Lowenthal from his underlying action. There was no other legal representation he needed at that point because once he was put on probation, his original case was done. He had no relationship with the public defender until after he was they filed a motion to revoke his probation.
Were you counsel of record in any capacity?
I was not,
Your Honor. Okay. So would it have been appropriate for the probation officer or therapist to respond to your phone calls?
Well, you know, I cannot address that directly. I was just trying to start a discussion on behalf of Mr. Durham as to whether or not these freedoms were properly being restricted.
That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. So there's no dispute that he attended all of the required SOTP meetings during the time period, had no unexcused absences, and followed or obeyed every single written or verbal restriction placed on him. But his probation was revoked, and he was sent to jail for a year. And he had his probation extended because in a letter written by a friend who was an attorney.
Just to confirm, Mr. Iskovitz, did your client serve 1 year in prison?
Yes, he did, Your Honor. He spent 30 days before the trial and then 11 months afterwards while he was first 30 days was while we were trying to raise bail for him. Because in a letter written by a friend who's an attorney, questions were raised about additional restrictions that had been placed on him orally by an unlicensed therapist in the SOTP program. Petitioner did not disregard or violate any of these additional requirements. He, through an attorney, only questioned their legality. The therapist had restricted petitioner from calling his mother, restricted him from attending religious services without her permission. The therapist prevented him from living with a woman because and sharing an apartment with her because in her opinion, he was victimizing her because he was living with her and no longer having sex with her. The same therapist said he was victimizing this other adult woman because he was having sex with her. Petitioner spent a year in jail because an attorney wrote a letter on his behalf questioning the legality of these restrictions that were not in writing and concerned to human beings' most basic freedoms.
Counsel, what would your response be to the circuit court's findings that there were other factors that upon which it based its termination, that he wasn't completely candid with the probation officer about when he had signed the contract, his signing of it under duress, and his declining to talk about it in his group sessions, that those are independent reasons, you know, whether the underlying contract was right or wrong or contained provisions that were, you know, excessive or not, that those other actions raised issues that were appropriate grounds for termination. What's your response to that argument?
Well, to go through each one, Your Honor, the question about duress. Well, when a person is being told that if he doesn't sign a piece of paper that restricts his personal freedoms, that he's going to go to, his probation's going to be revoked and go to jail, well, that certainly sounds like duress. There was no analysis done by the lower court or by the ICA whether or not he met the legal definition of duress. He was told he cannot hug a woman, he could not hold hands with a woman without the prior consent of the group therapist and the entire group. With regard to everything else, the court made these conclusions, but there was not one discussion of an underlying fact that pertained to, did he participate in, did he show an unwillingness to participate in the program? Every single piece of evidence showed that he did. Making a conclusion that just basically mimicked what the sex offender therapist said was not an analysis of whether the thing was justified. It was just repeating what the therapist said in the termination of treatment report. There was no discussion there. Now, with regard to whether discussion of the letter in group therapy was grounds to terminate him, I would submit that this was a matter of legal rights. At the test, there was no testimony that said he did not speak did not discuss it. The probation officer at the hearing, in fact, said she wasn't sure what was discussed, whether the letter was discussed or the underlying reasons for the letter. But also, as the PD pointed out in their brief, she misinterpreted this letter as a threat to sue her and the probation officer. So she's trying to get information about what this threat might be about, which I would submit would be improper discussion within the group, especially without an attorney present on his behalf. If he's talking about his legal rights, she's asking questions about him discussing his own legal theories about what may or may not have been accurate.
Thank you, Counsel.
Mr. Iskovich, what remedy are you seeking today?
Well, you know, I'm basically saying that the bottom line is I'm asking this court to reverse the circuit court's order revoking his probation and restoring his original sentence, on the basis that there's just nothing in the record that would support that the petitioner willfully and inexcusably violated a substantial condition of his probation. Because there's really no question that it was solely this letter.
Mr. Iskovich, when would his original probation end?
September 2012. Under the 5-year sentence that was issued, it would be June 2014. But it was solely this letter, this questioning, that got him terminated from the program. As Chief Judge Nakamura found in dissent, he stated, the mere submission of a letter by an attorney friend complaining about certain restrictions imposed on Durham as part of his treatment did not demonstrate that Durham's termination from the Catholic Charities program was justified. Although the therapist provided a total of 4 reasons for terminating Durham from the Catholic Charities program, all were related to the complaint letter. Significantly, the record does not show that Catholic Charities would have terminated Durham for reasons other than the submission of the complaint letter.
Could the court consider the potential dangerousness of your client in determining whether to revoke probation?
Certainly, but there was absolutely no evidence that he had posed any danger to society. There were 3 separate SOTP therapists. Dr. Reed, who was did a 2-day assessment of him pursuant to adult probation services request, said he was not a predator and that, excusing science-based tools, he was low risk to reoffend. Dr. Gregory Turnbull, who we started seeing 8 days after termination from the Catholic Charities Program, said he was low risk, if any. And
dangerousness, I'm referring to the recommendation letter which said that your client had engaged in 4 other sexual assaults.
Well, I'm glad you raised that letter, because that letter was in direct violation of State versus Paina. That letter was never made part of the record. It was never disclosed to the defendant or the defendant's attorney. That letter was that secret letter. Ms. Nishikawa, the probation officer from Maui, who had never met Mr. Durham, wrote the probation violation report and included false statements in that. That we received, the defendant received a copy of. But at the same time, she wrote a confidential sentencing letter 9 months before the hearing that accused Mr. Durham of having committed 4 prior sexual assaults and that he was at high risk to reoffend. All of those accusations are completely false. There is not one reference in any pre-sentencing report or anything in the record whatsoever, nothing, that should suggest he committed any prior sexual assaults, let alone 4.
Counsel, is there anything in the record to establish the circuit court relied on those factual, would you contend are factual inaccuracies in that letter regarding the 4 alleged prior sexual assaults?
Well, because there was never raised, this letter, the understate, there's nothing in the record. There's no discussion during the court hearing because the petitioner was not aware that this letter existed. He was not aware that these accusations had been made against him. So we did not have a discussion, but we do know this. Ms. Nishikawa, though she was in the hallway, was not called as a witness. We do know that when it came time to sentencing, there was no discussion about what the sentencing recommendation was, but the judge stated, the circuit court stated, that we're going to follow the probation officer's recommendation of 1 year in jail and 5 years of probation. So, and the prosecutor likewise referenced that letter. So we do know she read the letter. We do know that the Judge Liu read the letter, but we do not know if she relied specifically on the comments, but it was pretty...
Did the judge say explicitly rely on the recommendation of 1 year or rely on the recommendation that probation be revoked? Because there was a recommendation in the record that probation be revoked that was part of the record, correct? There's a motion to revoke probation.
That's correct, but the only reference of 1 year, sentencing 1 year, was in that secret letter that the defendant never saw.
And the court did explicitly refer to that recommendation in your view?
Yes, he did. Yes, she did, excuse me. She absolutely did in the transcript.
What about the prosecutor made you feel that, what's in the record that shows that the prosecutor knew about the letter?
He said the same thing. He basically said, I go along with the recommendations made by the probation officer in her recommendation letter. That is stated in the transcript.
Okay. But that's after the judge says that, right?
First the judge said it, and then I'm not exactly sure the timing, but it was right next to each other. It was obvious that the letter had been written before by both of them and that they both referenced it during the discussion about sentencing.
Are you saying the prosecution had a copy of the letter?
Most definitely, Your Honor.
The recommendation letter?
Yes, sir. Had to, because he referenced it in the discussion of sentencing prior to the sentencing being issued. The prosecutor had a copy of it?
Is he supposed to have a copy of the recommendation letter?
Is the prosecutor supposed to have it?
Yes.
That's a rule of the court. I can't respond to, but...
When you say the rule of the court, you mean that's the policy of the court, that the prosecutor gets a copy of the recommendation letter?
I don't know what the practice and policy is in the Second Circuit Court with regard to sentencing recommendation letters. But this is apparently what happened.
So in the argument before the judge pronounces sentence, the prosecutor makes reference to having seen and read the recommendation letter?
Yes, Your Honor. That is in the transcript.
Mr. Iskovitz, may I ask you a question, please? I'm looking at the opening brief for the defendant appellant, which authored by, I guess, the public defender. And at page 23, the first full paragraph, the circuit court erred in revoking Durham's probation where the record evinced that he was doing everything he could do after his termination from sex offender treatment program. And then further down in the paragraph, it says, Billings' overreaction to a meddling third party's interference in this case This is especially true where Durham's termination from SOTP was based on Billing's overreaction to a meddling third party's interference in this case. That's a reference to you, is it not?
It most definitely is, Your Honor.
Okay. Is that still the defense position on that, or are you now saying that what you did was appropriate? I'm not clear because of your earlier argument.
If I had to do it over again, I may have changed a sentence or two in the letter, but the letter stated facts, and I believe it accurately stated the law with regard to whether or not, if a judge could not issue these kind of restrictions on a probation officer, that it was improper for a person who was not a judge to impose these restrictions. So, yes, the defense is saying that the letter sent was proper and accurately stated both the facts and the law with regard to the situation.
But that the letter amounted to ineffective assistance of counsel, that is a part of what the defense claims.
The defense no longer claims that. The only ineffective assistance of counsel that took place was the public defender, but that's not an issue before this court today.
Thank you.
So, basically, Chief Judge Nakamura concluded that he believed...
If, in fact, your client, the contention is that he poses a danger, is that the kind of thing that the court should review?
If it's properly before the court, most definitely.
How would it be properly before the court?
If there's testimony that says this man is a danger to society because of X. If you bring in a counselor that says this man is a predator, that didn't happen here. The only, you know, there is no evidence.
Why are you entitled to that?
Why
are you entitled to that information?
Well, in accordance to State versus Paina, if there's any information that's not in a pre-sentencing report, that's in the confidential sentencing recommendation, the court has a duty to disclose that information to the defendant so that he can rebut it. Basic due process requires that if something is being used, if there's evidence that's being used against him, the petitioner must be given a chance to defend against it. How can we defend against a false accusation if we don't know about it?
But what if the court doesn't rely on it, on that accusation?
The State versus Paina makes it clear that if the new evidence is in that letter, they have a duty to turn it over. There is no discretion there. They can't say, well, since I'm not using it. But the point I'd like to make is that if a judge receives a letter that says he's committed four prior sexual assaults, he's had high risk to reoffend. Well, if in fact that those accusations are true, there's not a person in this room who would not agree that that guy is probably a bad guy that deserves to go to jail. But if that same judge, knowing he has a duty to disclose those additional facts to the defendant, chooses not to disclose it, then he knows, we all know, that that judge is going to find a way to find that defendant guilty. And that's what this judge did in this case.
Is the order of the court similar or the same as the recommendation letter points? Does it follow the recommendation letter?
No, the actual order revoking probation, it does not. The order revoking probation actually makes the statement that the defendant, having admitted the allegations in the motion to show cause why his probation should be revoked.
I'm talking about the order that imposes new terms for the new probation. Does it follow what was in the recommendation letter?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. It does. It basically, there was a list of several things that the probation officer recommended. The primary ones were revoke his probation, give him 1 year in jail, and 5 years additional probation. And then
so
they added
the prosecutor said in the hearing, and I believe jail time is warranted, and I'll defer to the time that is requested by the probation officer in this case. What does that refer to?
That refers to the 1 year set forth in the confidential sentencing recommendation letter that was never disclosed to the defendant. The 1 year in jail and the 5 years probation.
Should the court determine whether or not there's a basis for that recommendation letter statement, should the court be given the opportunity to determine that?
I believe so. I believe the court, if it sees evidence of If it receives evidence of wrongful acts that it should impact either the trial or the sentencing, I believe the court should consider that and have a discussion about it. But the court should not hold on to that information and not disclose it. There has to be some disclosure to the defendant so that we can argue against it. Otherwise, the prosecutor, the probation officer can say anything they want. The judge can use that information to convict the defendant or revoke his probation, all without any kind of due process ability for the defendant to respond to it. That's
Counsel,
just not fair.
You're asking for us to reverse and reinstate the original term of probation, which in essence would deprive the trial judge of the opportunity to determine whether there was any basis to those allegations of four prior sexual assaults.
Yeah, but Your Honor, it was the duty of the judge to bring it forward. It was the duty of the prosecutor to bring it forward. So to go back to trial just because they violated this court's ruling in State versus Paina, I would suggest that there should be some sanction that should be given for them violating this court's rule, because there is nothing that the defendant could have done in this case that prevented him from moving forward as far as defending that case. To go back and talk about those particular things, there is just not a single fact that supports that argument, any of those facts, any of those allegations, if there was anything at all. And I know I'm past my 20 minutes, and I just want to bring up the second issue very quickly, which is that the issue is whether he can be found guilty of revoking his probation if, in fact, he was fully compliant. The fact is there was only a three-week gap in his attendance in the sex offender treatment program. He went from Catholic Charities to the Community Assistance Center's program. Within 3 weeks, he found the program on his own. He got accepted into it. And most importantly, before he went there, his probation officer approved him attending that session. What is his condition? It is a condition that he satisfactorily participate in a program approved by his probation officer. That is exactly what this petitioner did. And still, they revoked his probation. I submit to the court that if a person is terminated from a program within a reasonable time, attends another program that's been approved by his probation officer, then as a matter of law, you can't revoke his probation. And thirdly,
is that two probation officers approve his reenlistment in a different sexual abuse treatment program.
That's correct. He was in a program, he was terminated, he found another program, he was started within 3 weeks, but he only started that after his probation officer said it's okay to go to that one. So what more could this defendant have done? What more could he have done to sustain his compliance with his conditions of probation? He did everything he could. There isn't one thing that he could not have done more than what he did. And the case law in State versus Wong, in State versus Nakamura, State versus Huggett, it all comes down to, was he willfully and inexcusably, did he do something bad? Did he to deserve the revocation of probation? You look at his conduct. You look at, was it willful? You look at the notice he was given. But just like in Nakamura, when Habitat would not let him come in because they violated one of his rules, and they revoked his probation and threw him in jail, and this court said, that's just not right. You have to look at the reasonableness of what happened here. And I submit that this court should not rely upon a therapist's conclusion that he did something wrong to justify the termination. If the standard is willful and inexcusable violation of a condition of probation, this court should look at what the underlying actions were. Was it willful and inexcusable what he did that resulted in his termination from the first program?
Thank you very much, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hanano?
May it please the Court, Chief Justice Rechtenwald, fellow justices. We're here today to review the decision by the Intermediate Court of Appeals to determine whether or not they gravely erred in rendering that decision. I'll first start off by responding to appellant's, characterization of the recommendations that were provided to the court. I wasn't the attorney that handled the hearing in that case, but I know from practicing in circuit court for a number of years that the state does not get a copy of the recommendations to the judge, and there's no evidence that we did in this case. And we probably found out or got a copy of it when it was served on us by defense counsel when it was attached to some pleading that was filed on appeal. And as far as that document is concerned, that's not part of the record on appeal. So with respect to that argument, we're asking this court not to consider it. The state didn't have a chance to brief it. The ICA didn't have a chance to look at it and analyze it and consider, you know, arguments from both sides regarding
that.
There
was a motion for reconsideration, was there not?
There was.
Did you respond to the motion?
I'm not sure if we did or not.
But you had an opportunity to respond.
Yes, Your Honor.
So but you did have an opportunity to brief it.
I guess if you're, yeah, if that's what you're saying, then yes.
I just want to be sure we're clear on what transpired.
Right. Yeah. But as far as...
I'm sorry. You had an opportunity to respond to the application also, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And did you?
No, we didn't. Okay. And again, I was asked to cover this matter recently. I was not the attorney who actually wrote the brief. But yes, I agree that as far as the motion to reconsider and the petition, we did have an opportunity, I guess, to respond in those things.
Mr. Hanano, would you agree that having new information in a letter and not disclosing it to defense counsel and defense counsel, is that a violation of PAINA?
It could be, depending on the content of the information.
Did you see the letter?
Yes, I did.
Is that a violation of PAINA?
It could be if there's evidence that the court relied on the new factual allegations in
Does
that information.
Does PAINA require the court to rely on it?
I'm not sure.
Well, how do you account for the argument of the prosecutor asking for jail time if the prosecutor never saw the letter?
Right, and I just had an opportunity to look at the transcript, and it's not clear whether or not from that recommendation the prosecutor, you know, knew that the probation officer was going to recommend a year, or we had a copy of the recommendations. All it says is we're going to defer to the recommendations of the probation officer, which is what, you know, we do a lot of times without even knowing what the recommendations are. And you know, in that sense, we're relying on the probation officer to make an adequate recommendation as far
why
as
wasn't
time.
The why wasn't the probation officer? Do you know why the probation officer wasn't called to the stand?
You speaking about Ms. Nishikawa?
Whoever the probation officer was who wrote the secret letter.
I could not speculate as to why that person wasn't called. Okay. We did call Ms. Boom Lang, Humang Lang, who was a courtesy supervising probation officer for the First Circuit where the defendant's probation was transferred to. She testified extensively about the defendant's treatment in the sex offender treatment program as she was, you know, part of the team with the therapist in monitoring the defendant's progress in that program.
Mr. Hanano, respond to Mr. Iskovich's argument that while in similar circumstances we might remand for rehearing, why in Mr. Iskovich said this breach of PAINA is so severe that we should just reverse. Why shouldn't we do that?
Well, I think based on the circumstances, I think it would probably be reasonable for the court to remand it back for a rehearing.
What circumstances are that? That the court violated the...
Well, the fact that the prosecution didn't have a copy of it either. And, you know, we had no idea what was contained in there. If we did, you know, perhaps we would have called Ms. Nishikawa as a witness to elaborate on what was in the recommendation report, or call other witnesses, perhaps, you know, to support those allegations. and we didn't have an opportunity because apparently we didn't have a copy of it either. So your
position, counsel, is that this matter should be remanded for a further hearing at which those issues would be developed? And would that be in the context of this case or in a Rule 40 petition, in your view?
I would agree with Chief Justice Nakamura if this court is going to do that. I mean, if this court is going to overturn the ICA's majority decision, then the state would be asking that the case be remanded in order to explore those additional facts that were provided in the recommendation report. As far as the...
Just to clarify your position, are you saying remanded for a new probation hearing or not?
I think remand to explore the issues regarding the recommendation report that was provided to the court.
Would that be in a new probation hearing or not?
I think depending on what happens as a result of that Rule 40 petition, you know, then we could go from there to decide whether or not, you know, his probation.
Why would there be a need for a Rule 40 petition?
Again, because there's issues that, or actually, there's factual issues that need to be explored.
What factual issues?
Whether or not the state received a copy of the report.
Well, we all know you didn't, based on what you said.
Based on, interpretation of looking at the file and the record, and whether or not...
If you received it or not, would that have any effect on the requirements in PAINA?
Whether the state received it?
Yes.
I would say it would have an effect as far as, you know, our ability to protect the defendant's due process rights by, you know, providing witnesses, in which case they could cross-examine those witnesses or respond to them.
And you could do that in a probation hearing.
Yes, that's correct.
Any other factual matter that would have to be established?
As far as the recommendation report, I think whatever new facts that were alleged in the report need to be presented or explored to determine whether or not the state would present any evidence to that effect.
Any evidence on whether or not the defendant poses danger?
Yes,
for the future.
Yes. As far as the circuit court's conclusion that the defendant inexcusably failed to comply with a substantial term of or condition of probation, the state agrees with the Intermediate Court of Appeals that those four findings are supported by the record. The first finding involved a conclusion that the threat of legal action contained in the letter created an ethical conflict between the defendant and his therapist and interfered with the therapeutic relationship. I think in order to address that determination, this court should look at whether or not the language in the letter could be reasonably construed as a threat of a lawsuit. And the state believes that to a reasonable layperson, it could be construed as a threat of a lawsuit. If you look at the letter, there's there's references to violating of the defendant's, quote, fundamental constitutional rights. The letter uses terms such as constitutionally invalid conditions, and therefore, you know, to someone who is not an attorney, and you know, in conjunction with the tone of the letter, I think it would be reasonable to, you know, construe that letter as a threat of a potential lawsuit. As to the second finding by the ICA, allegations in the letter demonstrated Durham's resistance to treatment and lack of desire to participate. I think this court should look at whether or not the letter was written at the, I guess, direction of the defendant. And if you look at the letter, it's very detailed as to, you know, names of people, factual circumstances, you know, what he disagreed with the therapist and the program. So for them to say that, you know, he had no idea about this letter, or maybe not that far, but that, you know, just because someone else writes a letter on your behalf doesn't mean that, you know, you knew about it or anything like that, I think that would be erroneous because of the content of the letter. And also, if you look at the tone, I mean, it kind of is consistent or corroborates the defendant's, you know, feelings as far as his treatment. He submitted a declaration in the motion to reconsider. And if you look at that declaration, there's, I think, 150 paragraphs. And that letter, that declaration is very similar to the tone and the allegations in the letter that was written by defense counsel. As far as the third determination by the ICA that defendant signed a behavior contract under duress, signaled a resistance to treatment, the state would agree with that as well. Prior to the contract being implemented, there are circumstances that led up to the need for the therapist to implement that contract. And those were things such as the defendant admitting that he was in a situation that was later determined by the therapist and the group to be a high risk. Also that
Mr. Hanano, none of those things, though, ever resulted in a recommendation to terminate the defendant from the program, or for either from Catholic Charities or the probation department.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree with that. And it's
so
clear.
The only thing that triggered this was the letter and the feeling, I guess, of the therapist that they might be open to a lawsuit, and that kind of thing interfered with the therapy or the therapeutic relationship.
I agree with that the letter was a trigger, but that was not the entire basis for the termination, I should say. I think this court should look at the totality of the circumstances and in determining whether or not his termination was excusable. And I think what we need to focus on is the defendant's conduct throughout the entire time. He was in the program for about 8 months. And, you know, by that time, you should be on board. He wasn't. And that's obvious from the under duress statement that he added there on the contract. It's obvious in his attitude towards his therapist. I think in his declaration he even said that, she's not even licensed to run this program or treat me. I think those are factors that indicate his resistance and lack of cooperation in the treatment.
And the closing statement, from Catholic Charities said that the reason he was terminated was because of the threat of a lawsuit.
Well, that was by, I think, Ms. Billings, I think, who was the director or coordinator of the entire program. But there is evidence on the record from the actual probation officer who was involved with the actual therapist that was assigned to the defendant. And you know, there's substantial evidence from that therapist, from that probation officer, which indicates that, that wasn't the only reason. That was a trigger, but that was not the sole reason. And I think, you know, it's up to the district court as a finder of fact to determine, you know, what was the actual reason or reasons why the defendant was terminated from the program. The final issue is defendant was unwilling to fully participate in group therapy by refusing to discuss the letter with the group. So there was some allegation that as soon as the treatment program received the letter, he was terminated. As we know from the evidence in the case, that's not true. They tried to work with him. They tried to tell, hey, you know, why don't we discuss this in a group? He refused, and then he got terminated. So to say that, you know, as soon as the letter was written, he got terminated, that's not supported by the record. It appears that the defendant at some point felt trapped. He felt like he was being overly controlled, and basically checked himself into the hospital for depression and anxiety. And I think at that point is when the defense attorney got involved and started, you know, advising him to put, you know, that you're under duress or say this and wrote that letter. You know, we know that sex offender treatment programs have a lot of dynamics in there that to maybe a layperson might seem unreasonable, but, you know, they're the experts. They're contracted by the state. They have reasons why they do what they do. And for the defendant to basically get in there and resort to self-help and try to fight the program, I think, is not a good thing, and this is what happens. So we're asking this court to basically uphold the decision by the Intermediate Court of Appeals and find that the defendant did, in fact, inexcusably fail to comply with a substantial condition of probation. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Iskowitz, and how much time does he have remaining for rebuttal? 6 minutes remain.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, in rebutting that there was no evidence that the prosecutor received a copy of the letter, the state had ample opportunity in response to the motion for reconsideration and the petition for writ of certiorari. The prosecutor could have filed a declaration saying, I never received a copy. He was accused of having received a copy, clearly, but he could have taken a chance to deny it. He chose not to. So based upon the record of this case, there's an unanswered accusation, and based upon the actual transcript, it is pretty clear he saw the letter. Whether or not past procedure is that they don't get a copy of the letter, it was pretty clear that he received a copy of the letter in this one. As to why Ms. Nishikawa was not called, she was out in the hallway. She could have been called, but the fact was she had never met with the defendant one time during his entire time on probation because he was on Oahu the whole time being supervised. So she writes this whole report, she writes this whole letter, never having met with him, never having any discussion with him, and solely relying on somebody's others, who knows what she relied on to come up with this stuff. With regard to the first finding, was this letter really a threat of legal action? I submit it was not. If a person cannot question whether or not restrictions being placed on him violate his fundamental constitutional rights, where have we come to? If the letter said, if you don't do this, I'm going to sue you, well, that's one thing. That's an aggressive thing. But to say, please meet, let's talk about this. Otherwise, I'm going to have to file a motion with the court to amend the terms of probation. Well, that seemed to be a much less aggressive way of going about it than going ahead and filing a motion first. Let's get a chance. Let's talk about it. This is what lawyers do. They sit down and they talk and try to work things out before bringing in the court. The ICA didn't refer to it as a threat to sue. They just said it interfered with the relationship. But how? Letters get to be written. How else can we bring this to play? And to say that he was showing the resistance to treatment, it was all about the letter. The court says it was just a small part of it. The state just acknowledged that it was the trigger. There was nothing else. Chief Judge Nakamura made it very clear it was the letter, nothing but the letter. Now, the state has not responded to the issue of he was fully compliant with condition. Why was it his attendance at the CAC program, why wasn't that sufficient to satisfy his condition? That issue was never addressed. There was a 3-week gap. And if you look at the court's rulings before, look at his whole conduct. He was exemplary. He did everything right. And to say there's ample evidence, he said there's ample evidence to prove that he was violating, that he was interfering with relationship. It's easy to conclude that. It's much harder to find anything in the record that supports that. There is not one iota that said he interfered with his relationship. Instead, he voluntarily said, I had a relationship, I had a sexual episode with an adult woman who has no children in her life. They said, that's a lapse. Why is that a lapse? There's nothing that was not violating any condition of his probation, as testified to the probation officer at the hearing. It did not violate any rule of the SOTP. Why was he told he lapsed and had to sign a contract saying if he thinks he's going to be interested in a woman, he can't hold her hand, he can't hug her without the group and the therapist agreeing to it first? Why is that fair? How can it be that that's allowed? So he questioned it. So to question whether a right, you know, if the person said you have to jump off the ledge, I mean, what, there has to be some limit. And with regard to the fourth finding, the letter was written on June 25th. The group met that evening on the 25th without any discussion with the group, without any discussion with the defendant. He was terminated 2 days later, June 27th. So it wasn't like there was a time period between the letter. He was terminated as a direct result of the letter, and Chief Justice Nakamura said it. There is no evidence on the record that indicates that there was anything other than the letter that supported, that justified the revocation. And again, with the issue of duress, the state did not address the issue as, if a person is being threatened to going to jail if he doesn't sign something, well, that meets the legal definition of duress. There is nothing more basic than to, if you lose your rights of freedom, why can't you complain about it? Why can't you say it's under duress? Are you supposed to just, you know, the court did not say in its conditions of probation, you will do everything the SOTP counselor says, even if it violates your fundamental constitutional rights. It says you follow the program. And in society, if somebody tells you can't do something, well, you have a right to object to it.
Mr. Iskovich, don't we all enter into endeavors that violate our fundamental constitutional rights? I can't go outside and talk about this case. Doesn't that violate my right to free speech? But we accede to these because I want my job, and for your client because he wants probation.
Probation.
So there are circumstances under which one does give up your constitutional rights, aren't there?
I believe that there are some rights. There are definitely some rights that he gave up as a probationer, without question. But he did not give up his fundamental First Amendment rights. That's what it says in the Supreme Court, that you cannot, the probationer cannot be, the fundamental rights, if they're taken away, they must relate to the offense with which he is charged. To say that he can't hold hands with an adult woman when he's convicted of, having been convicted of a sex molest 3, well, what's the relation to that? There was no minor children involved. What's the relation to not going to religious services? What's the relation to not calling his mother? If there was any aspect where that has some impact on whether his conduct will lead to a reoffense, to a relapse, then yes, then you can restrict his rights. But how can you restrict his rights when he has done nothing wrong with regard to calling his mother or attending religious services? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Iskovitz. Thank you, Mr. Hanano. The court will take this matter under advisement.